Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Dr. Vinita Viswanath, a Bangalore-based social entrepreneur, organizational mentor, and researcher. Passionate about women's empowerment through entrepreneurship, up to 2014, Vinita was CEO of Ujjayini, an NGO she founded in 2000 to develop women entrepreneurs across India. Nowadays, she divides her time as an advisor to Sattva Consulting, as chair of migrant worker NGO Ajivika Bureau, and as a trustee of Jagriti Foundation. I spoke to Vinita face-to-face at a major conference on economic empowerment in Delhi. So Vinita, welcome to Change Hackers.
Thank you.
We're here as part of a series of interviews off the back of the BOP Global Network Summit, which has been taking place in Delhi this week. What's your takeaways from the event?
My takeaways from the event is that at one time we used to say, think global, act global. Now I'm saying you could think global, you really do have to act local and very local. Because the rapid changes around us are impacting the local in ways that is harder for them to handle than perhaps those who are more aware and who are traveling around the globe and are able to adapt themselves much more easily.
Give us some context in terms of what you see through your work.
I see through my work the aspiration of the rural populace, because the global has in some ways come to them through technology, through mobile phones, mostly through mobile phones. And there is a eagerness, almost a hunger, for understanding what that technology can do for them. So they do learn on their own when they're given a first view of what that technology looks like and its content. So they do try to read up on it. And wherever the content is in the local language, they do access it. So what I've seen is that young people who are in education, in healthcare, use the access and understanding of internet, if they can get a bandwidth in their villages adequately, to get the information they need to improve their own responses to questions in that sector.
Where did your own passion for your work originate from?
Actually, it originated with a doctoral dissertation I was doing back in the US. And it was actually my dissertation advisor who sort of questioned me and my interests to see whether I wanted to actually change the subject of what I had originally come there to do. And it's through that process that I began to think that I could add development to my... I'm a political scientist by training. And I was going to do pure political science, political parties, democratic system, and so on. But then the whole idea of the grassroots came, and civil society and the nonprofit sector, through this discussion. And finally, my dissertation ended up being about NGOs in India. And when I actually came to the ground, spent time at the ground, because this was a primary level study, so I spent 2-3 months in the field studying the work of the nonprofit and around the sector of microenterprise, that I finally got really interested in this and decided that that's really what I wanted to pursue as a career. And then I wrote a book on this. My dissertation became a book. So I had to revisit the field to update the book, the information in the book. And so I could see the change that I had sort of predicted in some ways would happen to the organizations when I originally started my dissertation. And that sort of enthused me even more to study this further and work on the ground and document a lot of the changes that I see.
And what came next then after the book? Was there a clear next step for you?
There wasn't a clear next step for me. I thought I would go in and teach in development studies. But then actually, as it happened, that family circumstances pushed me in a direction of Washington, D.C., where there was the World Bank. And that's actually where I started, you know, my proper career, if you like. I spent 5 years there. Mm-hmm. And I spent 5 years there in a part of the World Bank that was fairly insulated from the rat race of lending that the bank generally does. This was a part of the bank that could allow for some innovation, and that was in training. And when their training work was normally for policymakers, because that's the mandate of the World Bank, is to work with governments. Mm-hmm. And then there was this pot of money that came into the department I was in that said, can you think of somebody else who could get this training? That's where the idea of training women in enterprise and NGOs who work with women to be trained in how to build enterprise came about, through that pot of money. So it literally landed on my lap and said, do what you want with it. Now, that's a very rare
gift.
What a gift. That was very rare. And so I did what we wanted. Right. And that's how the organization that I became a part of when I came to India was started, through that World Bank project. It was called Udyogini. Udyogini means women entrepreneur. The Udyog means entrepreneur. We added the ini to make it sound female. Okay. So it became Udyogini. And so when I finished up with the bank and I decided to return to India, I hadn't actually thought of joining the organization. But then the board of the organization said, you know, guess what? You've been part of setting it up in some kind of way. You've been part of the founding team and conceptualizing the program that brought it into existence. So why don't you take this forward and take it to the next level if you're willing? So I thought about it. I took it up as a challenge and I joined as a CEO.
Just like that. And that was...
And that was in 2000.
So that would be your first CEO role.
Yes.
How did you adapt to that kind of a position?
It was difficult. It was difficult to adapt precisely because I was in an institution that had loads of money. And I never had to go looking for money. I, in fact, gave out money. Here I was coming as a CEO of a non-profit that has to go looking for money. Mm-hmm. And I actually didn't know how to do that.
You had no fundraising experience.
I had no fundraising experience. Right. This organization was funded by a World Bank project, which at one time didn't need any funding and wasn't struggling for money. But once that project ended, it needed to diversify its sources of funding. And there was really, that fell to me to do as CEO.
A baptism of fire?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a tough one. And it is... That was apart from other challenges, which is that, you know, running an organization was new to me. I had never worked directly in a nonprofit before. Mm-hmm. So almost everything in that role was completely new. Plus, I had a research brain and I had to shift that to a little bit more of an implementation capacity, etc., and understanding all that. And so I was fortunate to have a few friends in the development sector who were from management schools. Not to say that they have too much implementation experience themselves, but at least they understood management a little bit, you know, differently, could understand it. I was a researcher. So they helped me look at this strategically while also helping me to understand managing organizations.
And how did you adapt to the people side of this, in terms of managing people, leading people?
The managing people, leading people was a little bit more difficult. And that's where I got somebody from the sector to do a strategic plan for me and a business plan for me that sort of showed me the way to go about doing it. What are the areas that I needed to strengthen within the organization, and how to go about doing it, including going and doing to universities and management schools to recruit the people I wanted, which kinds of schools were likely to yield the kind of people we were looking for.
Yes.
So that, and making the pitches at those schools during the recruitment period for those schools.
How many people were you responsible for at the point when you took over?
The point at which I took over, there were maybe a half a dozen.
Okay.
And by the time I left, about 15 years later, we had about 100. Right. 150, yeah.
Right. By which time, the idea of being responsible for 100 people and their livelihoods and their families and all that you're bearing as the CEO really would have become accustomed to. But in the early days, without the fundraising experience, that must have been, even with six people.
No, it was not just fundraising experience, not lack of it was an issue, but the fact that it was six people who were reasonably demotivated because they were wondering whether the organization would survive.
Yes.
And so I didn't have a group around me, like a founding team, when a brand new organization starts. That's usually what happens.
Mm. You're not alone. You have bank funding.
You have at least one or two people around you who can help you to take this forward.
Mm.
And then with this group, it was different. So there was a reorganization that happened. The group did leave, not immediately, but within a few months. And then I had to recruit anew. So it was actually like starting a brand new organization. Mm-hmm.
But that's a re-energizing in a way as well, isn't it?
Yes, in some ways it worked better. Yeah. Yeah. But in some ways, the baggage of having been World Bank funded stayed for a while. To say, why are you looking for money? You should have loads of money. You were funded by the World Bank.
Mm.
So that can create a little bit of a problem in the donor community who's otherwise looking to fund an organization that doesn't have the resources.
Mm-hmm.
And the expectation was that you would.
So getting back to your point around shifting from the research brain to being more about operational implementation, what sort of learning curve did you go on in terms of refining the model and your theory of change?
I did a lot of reading, for one, to understand the implementation and the execution parts of it. I did get a group of people around me who would help me with that. The learning curve was also sort of complicated by the fact that, you know, the donors are also sitting on you to say, you know, this has to be done within this period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have those timelines that you have to adhere to. And at the same time, you're building your team to adhere to those timelines. So in a sense, not everything would work the way you want to work. But I think what I did was to pick one or two areas that I thought we would concentrate on and build the success on first before diversifying. So I think the fact that I worked on enterprise and entrepreneurship fairly narrowly in some ways helped because I was able to focus the team on looking at that goal.
Mm-hmm.
Though in the NGO world, especially in India, being so narrow can also be a little bit of an issue.
Mm-hmm. How hands-on are you?
In the beginning, I was pretty hands-on. In the early stages as an entrepreneur, you have to be hands-on. You go to the field a lot. I do enjoy going to the field. I do enjoy sitting with the community that we work with. So I do directly did all of that. But as the organization gets a bit bigger, you have to hand over some of those responsibilities to the others also to build them up. You know, somewhere I would say about halfway through my tenure in the organization, I started slowly thinking of writing up all the experiences we had. Mm-hmm. And because that's anyway my research brain. Mm-hmm. So I said, all right, let me use that to actually document some of this and have it disseminated.
Right. So you've left this organization now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what are you busy with now?
Right now, I work with another organization called Jagriti. They're also about entrepreneurship and enterprise. Which is the reason that I joined them and they asked me to join their board. But because this in some ways is also board run, the board members have a lot of input as mentors, as advisors, and even as monitors of the work. I do a lot of hands-on ground level work with this organization in some of the activities that they do.
Right.
The most well-known of their activity is to run this train journey annually from December 24th to January 7th every year across 8,000 kilometers of India. We lease the train from the railways. It takes 350 young people of the ages of 20 to 27 on that train with 50 facilitators who are more experienced in the development world and in the enterprise world. and stopping at about 10 places across the country where social entrepreneurs on the ground for a whole day talk to the to those who come off the train, expose them to their work in the field, and field questions from them regarding entrepreneurship. And we also take lessons on that train. Some of us who are mentors on the train spend our evening hours virtually halfway into the night taking sessions on that train. This has been going on for 10 years. This is a flagship. It's called the Jagriti Yatra. It has been replicated in 5 countries across the world, including the US, and the UK one is starting in June.
It's a pretty epic learning journey.
It is an epic learning journey. The idea is that when you enter the train, you are thinking of a job. When you exit the train, a good part of you thinks that, no, you can actually be an entrepreneur. I've just done a 10-year assessment of this, and the results are astounding.
Can you give us an individual example of how it's transformed someone's outlook?
It has transformed. We've noticed that it has transformed women more than men, because when women come, they've generally fought with their families to get on this train.
Right.
And so for them, the determination is probably greater to come off. So there are many who have started up non-profit organizations between 1 and 3 years of leaving the train, in education, in consulting, in water and sanitation. In fact, one of them started off in starting up retail stores in tier 3 or tier 4 towns for medicines, and has just been bought up by 1MG, which is a big medicine company. So the first exit has already happened for the entrepreneur who took that train journey and who started his enterprise within the first year.
Astonishing story.
Yeah.
So how are you replicating that model? Is it through a social franchise or?
No, it's free. I mean, in the sense that there are people who have heard about this journey from other parts of the world, and who have come and said, okay, we're going to take it back. In fact, the one in France is the most successful. It's been supported by the French government. So they get funding from the government. It has spawned off many other, it's called the Jagriti Yatra. It has spawned off many other yatras. One is a governance yatra in the north. There is something else. There are about a half a dozen different yatras. They're not train journeys. They're bus journeys.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the rural ones, smaller ones, have taken either their bus journeys or they are something else, walking. Some of them are walking ones on foot called the yatra. Not quite the Shodh Yatra of Anil Gupta, but a little different, where they want to build themselves up to understand. Not all of them are on entrepreneur journeys, but governance is about meeting people, local politicians, to teach them about governance. The other part of this initiative is to support the alumni. We have 4,000 alumni of this since the 10 years it's been in existence. So putting them in touch with mentors and technical support agencies and financiers, so that they can build up their enterprise.
And are they pretty well networked between themselves as well?
Yes, yes. We have a site, a networking site for them online. And somebody does manage that site from the Jagriti. The third initiative is an incubator, business incubator in Eastern UP in one district. Just as a way to saturate. It is a model of saturation of entrepreneurship in one district with the entrepreneurs who are already working there. And they are tier 3, tier 4 districts, informal entrepreneurs who are running their businesses, who are working on the fringes of formality and who need to now be a little more compliant of the law and be able to scale.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the secret ingredients are in the Yatra?
I think the two main ingredients, as also reported by the Yatris, is the fact that when they walk into the train, they're very nervous, that they're very young and don't seem to know very much.
What sort of age are they?
20 to 27. They're students mostly.
Students,
Or they've just finished their courses.
Okay.
So all a little confused about their goals.
Mm-hmm.
But they feel very confident when they leave the train. There are at least 300 other people who have the same confusion. So they feel very sort of have a sense of comfort that they're not alone in the fact that they are still seeking clarity in what they wish to do. Mm-hmm. And the second main element that is transformational on that train is the exposure to social entrepreneurs on the ground and their journeys that they've heard. And when these are all senior social entrepreneurs, so their journeys span about 30 years. So they'll get to hear the full thing, whatever it is that they've done and their challenges. And there's a generational shift now. So they're able to speak to young people to say what was different, what is different now than what it was in their time.
So in terms of your own journey, where do your passions take you next? I mean, is this something that's going to remain a focus for you?
My passions continue to remain learning from real experience. But because the researcher in me still remains, I want to actually be able to construct theoretical frameworks out of what we are doing and the new experiences on the ground, which may not be served by the existing frameworks that we have been using. Mm-hmm. And maybe we need to shift the focus a bit and understand this more. And that's what I'm hoping that globally we can sort of start disseminating. If the learning for me from this summit is precisely that with all these different labs around the country, around the world, the other labs could probably also use some of what it is that we can produce in India.
Clearly, the model has a great deal of efficacy, and you've demonstrated that through your assessment report. They'll be generalizable findings from it as well. So different models could spring up that follow the same sort of principles.
Right.
And that's happening to some extent already. But the potential for many, many more of them and having a profound impact on young entrepreneurship and self-efficacy around being an entrepreneur seems to be very incredibly powerful. There's a whole number of other sorts of attempts at learning journeys, experiential learning around the world too, whether it's a sort of Shoka Fellows program or whether it's ULab and many other sort of smaller programs. It seems like it's on the rise, an increasing acceptance of experiential learning as being, having a really valid role to play as part of rounding out someone's education.
Right.
Where do you think the sweet spot is in terms of the age that you work at with people? Do you think you've got it about right with the sort of university leavers?
Yes, I think so. I think, well, university leavers in India actually still will end up probably in higher education first before they go into entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
We don't have a system in India where we encourage people to leave school and start something. I think that's still not yet gained currency. I'm sure it'll be looked down upon by parents and so on who are financing the education. Even as it is, about two years ago when I was on that train and I gave an entire session on enterprise, and the question and answer time came, and there wasn't a single question on enterprise. It was about life. It was about my journey. And not necessarily as an entrepreneur, but as a person. And then I discovered that almost all of people sitting in that train were united by the fact that they weren't terribly happy with what they were already doing. And we're all looking for change, even as young as 25. And most of them who were in technical education were doing community work on their side just to get away from the monotony of their education and technical stuff that they were doing during school hours. So many of them are actually looking to understand how does a social entrepreneur build up the variety in his or her life that enables him or her to do many different things, especially in my case as a woman, as a family, having children and so on. How did you manage all of that? And the women were most interested in knowing.
Do you think there's something particular around millennials and entrepreneurship that defines them differently from generations that have come before? You know, generations that expected a job for life or job security or, you know, had a profound sense of loyalty to their employer, whereas millennials seem to be embracing the idea of entrepreneurship rather more than previous generations. Do you recognize that?
I think it's because they hear about it. They don't know too much about it. I think the also is that millennials have a lot more choice than we ever did. A lot more choice about what they can do, when they can do it, and how much they can do, they want to do. We all went through a fairly standard practice of having an undergrad degree and then a master's degree and then going to look for a job. And our courses were fairly defined. You were either an engineer, a doctor, or a lawyer, or something very similar, which allows you a job at the end. Now you've got a variety of different professional courses that are available to you, and many of them have full undergraduate degrees, like design, for example. And so I think the options are a lot more, which is fortunate, but it can also cause a lot of confusion, which is why they're looking for clarity.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, change hackers.